Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Don sitting in the host chair today. Happy to be joined by a couple of intelligent, bright, insightful, articulate people. So at least that covers two-thirds of what you're going to hear on the podcast, and I'll try to catch up and stay up with them. For those of you that remember our episode not too long ago, still in the building, Dylan Holzimer from Memphis. He and I talked Elvis, so we've talked a pop culture episode, but Dylan's been an active participant in terms of suggesting items via the website and participating at our Discord server. And we said we were going to revisit an episode, and Dylan said, I'd like to be part of that when it happens. So I wanted to make sure and reach out and do it. So Dylan, happy to have you joining us today for your second stint here on A Fork in Time.
Thank you, Don. It's a pleasure. I'm sure I will find some way to shoehorn Elvis into this episode, too.
Well, you know, it's not an episode with you unless Elvis gets mentioned. And by the way, you just did. So you've already covered it. So there you go. And I'm also joined by Chris, you wear so many hats and so many titles in this podcast, but Chris Coppola. And Chris, it's just appropriate for me to suggest to you that you need to say hi to the good people.
Hi to the good people.
All right. Now it's officially at A Fork in Time episode. I mentioned here that we're coming back to revisit. It's a recent episode that we entitled Ike Wiped, and we don't have a lot of the crew here for this recording that were on that recording. That included Eric Rush and Robert Koshu. And so we've decided to come back and revisit the topic. For those of you that remembered, as we got towards the end of that episode, and the premise of that episode was Eisenhower dying from the heart attack that he suffered in the mid-50s. And we got towards the end of that episode as we were beginning to go down the various strands of an alternate timeline with the Nixon presidency. And we were coming across just all kinds of loose ends and potential ripples and forks. And we said, we're going to have to come back to this. So that's what we're doing here today. And to keep us a little more focused, at least in theory, that's what we're going to try to do. To keep us a little more focused here, we've decided for this particular extension of that, which we're really going to pick up with the 1960 election. Let me just put us where we're going to pick this, sort of pick things back up from, is to keep it focused on the alternate history moving forward under that scenario domestically. And our plan is to come back with yet another episode where we focus on the foreign policy implications. Obviously, there'll be overlap. You can't avoid this type of thing inevitably. But the idea here is to make this one a little bit more focused on what would have happened domestically under that alternate timeline. And then we'll probably have some of the same crew back that was there for the first episode, who I think they were heading in the foreign policy direction a lot more anyway. So that's probably where they would like to jump back in. So I think that works well. So again, trying to set up now the alternate history, what did, which is sort of a weird thing we don't often get to do. We've got Nixon in the presidency and running for re-election in 1960. And what we agreed upon during our very engaging off-podcast discussion, which is probably going to be at least as much fun or maybe even better than the actual episode here before it's all said and done, was that we believe Nixon wins that election in a closely fought, hard-fought contested election, much as the real Nixon Kennedy was in 1960. The difference here being Nixon is the incumbent president, not the incumbent vice president. And guys, we talked about a couple of different candidates. Who did we finally settle on as the Democrat that's running against Nixon? Which, by the way, I think we determined that Henry Cabot Lodge is his vice president. Is that what we decided during the discussion as well? So we've got a Nixon Lodge ticket for the Republicans in 1960. And who did we settle on for the Democrats in 1960 and why? I see Chris smiling. So Chris, you just nominated yourself.
Somebody who had a little bit of experience running for president, a guy named Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. This would be his first time running as an actual Democrat, thinking about this in terms of what we kind of thought is this would be a little bit like the Goldwater run in 64 on the Republican side. This is kind of a return kind of a, I don't want to say like conservative strike back, but a return to more of the traditional Democratic base. It also raises interesting questions for what happens in this first televised debate. Do they have enough tape? Do they run out of it? Because we know how long Strom Thurmond can talk about things. I don't feel like they're under those lights reading the Washington, D.C. phone book, but I'm not going to say no to that. Dylan, do you want to jump in there about me?
Yes. So I think Strom Thurmond is a good kind of alternative in terms of a 1960 opponent. I do think that that election debate on television, I think, even if it is televised, I think probably still goes in favor of Nixon, just because, like you guys talked about on the first part, Nixon's the young guy. He's, in a comparison between Thurmond and Nixon, probably the more attractive, just an educated guess. He's not running up against a Harvard-educated, you know, Ivy League graduate who's got Joe Kennedy money behind him. So I think it's perfectly believable that Nixon, especially with the diplomatic bona fides, not just himself, but with Cabot Lodge behind him, you know, going up against somebody like Thurmond, and I don't even want to guess who the vice president would be. You know, I think a lot of people who just tend to go towards the status quo boat and sort of keep the ship aright and it's running fine, we're going to keep it running that way. I think it's perfectly an easy enough thing to see that even though it's still going to be close, it's going to be close the other way, close-ish. It's not going to be as close as if Kennedy was running, but, you know, we'll see.
And I think the other thing that goes with that, Dylan, that popped into my head is that, you know, the cycle of American politics, we tend after 8 years of any party being in power that it flips in the other direction. It's that sort of pendulum concept in American politics that has really prevailed over, well, a long time. It seems to go back and forth. But if you think about that, those the middle election, that election for someone, the incumbent running for their second term, you know, it's always, it seems like it's always a sacrificial lamb or some offshoot thing that's happening there. So the idea, you know, that it, while it might not be the best outcome for success on the national level with Thurmond running in 60, you could easily imagine that happening because, you know, we're probably not going to necessarily win anyway. So why not?
But it's very much a way to shut this gadfly up.
Right.
Who's already, by the way, gone off the reservation himself and run against a Democratic president. So this is a way to throw him out there and embarrass him almost.
Yeah, I agree. So we get a we get Nixon reelected in 60. And we said we were going to focus domestically here. What's different about the second Nixon term domestically versus what we know? This is that place where we really get a big contrast from real history, much more than we had, of how different is Nixon versus Eisenhower in the late 50s. Now we're talking about Nixon as president versus Kennedy in the early 60s. So domestically, what are some of the big things that jump out there?
The first thing I'm thinking about is the huge issue of the early 60s being civil rights. And I think it's often lost that people think civil rights began with the election of John Kennedy. It didn't. It began, and we'll definitely get to this later, with the Supreme Court case. And there had been other things leading up to it. But Brown Board was in 54, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you had already had that. You had already had the bus boycott. You had already had the Greensboro sit-in campaign. So it was already going. And you also had a Republican president deploy federal troops to integrate the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I mentioned that multiple times, I know, on this and other things, but I think at this point there is still a string within the Republican Party of them being the party of Lincoln, and especially having just beaten Strom Thurmond, that definitely comes out more. Now, the question being, is a Nixon president more effective than a Kennedy president? Less effective than a Johnson presidency? How effective is he in approaching this issue? And that I'm going to throw out there. And I have some ideas, but I'm open to what other people think.
Yeah, I want to hear what Dylan has to say about that.
Yeah, it's a dangerous question asking a lawyer about some of the most famous legislation of the 20th century. So I think I'm with you, Chris. It's interesting to see what would be different. I think at least in terms of the early civil rights movement, in terms of, you know, the things that are happening in the late 50s, I think there's going to be some minor variations between Nixon and Eisenhower, but a lot of it you can kind of use interchangeably. You know, I think the 57 Civil Rights Act is still going to pass. The 60 Civil Rights Act is still going to pass because basically all it did was fix the 57. 64 and 65 and the Fair Housing Act in 68, that gets to be more of an interesting question. You know, when Nixon wins in 60, he's sworn in early 61, just in time for the Freedom Rides to go through the South with a bunch of people from the SCLC and various organizations to boost voting and things like that. Not to go too far into the horrible, you know, sort of occurrences that happened, but basically a lot of people did not come back from those. And I think if a Republican is in office, especially Chris, like you talked about, being still somewhat of the party of Lincoln and also the party of Teddy Roosevelt before he left and started the Bull Moose Party, there's still probably, you know, other than, you know, maybe some dalliances of and straying in the Great Depression, there's still a decent argument to be made that this is the progressive party. This is the party that advances interests. So, you know, I think something would still happen. I don't know that it would be the same Civil Rights Act of 64, you know, that protects a lot of anti-discrimination rules to the extent that it does. You know, you may be seeing a more stripped down version of it or a version that's focused on different things. But I think it would be, I think it's too natural of a progression, especially when Nixon has kind of taken the steward of, yes, I was the one that sent troops into Little Rock. He's the one that ends up, you know, potentially having a square down with George Wallace at the University of Alabama, you know, kind of taking this and not later sort of turning and, you know, sort of courting the South as his alternative to the Northern industrial bastion, sort of the Rust Belt Democrats. You know, I think it's kind of an interesting start to civil rights, especially because of the court cases. But I think also you have things like the EPA may come in, what was that, 10 years earlier than originally done? You know, Nixon did not do... Oh, OSHA, that's right. I forget he did OSHA. So I think in under Nixon, you start to see some of the Republican Party in the early 60s almost start, not a full realignment at that point, but a different one where they become kind of a more of a big, quote unquote, big government, but more in terms of a regulatory enforcement party. Whereas the Democrats have this kind of history, especially through the 50s, when you start getting back into Southern Democrats and Dixiecrats, kind of retrenching back to the sort of states' rights, you know, Calhoun, Clay, post-Civil War sort of argument. So I think it's really kind of an interesting place to see what kind of jumps off, but it's hard to say exactly where past the Civil Rights Act of 60, because at that point you've got a whole assassination and some legislative momentum going for Johnson that's just not there, that we don't know what that would have changed in terms of legislation.
Yeah, I hearkening back to the episode that we referenced here, the one that was, you know, the first in this, didn't know it was going to be a series at the time, but it's becoming one, is, you know, we talked in that episode at one point about, you know, and the classic phrase is, you know, Nixon was the guy that could go to China. Why? Because of his communist bona fides. you know, Johnson could push through civil rights legislation in the real time 160s because of, you know, being, I think as Chris said in that episode, having that particular accent, you know, was what was needed to be there. And so I do think is the idea that you would have seen that movement at the civil rights, I think, as Dylan well pointed out, you would have seen something maybe a little bit less, I don't want to say aggressive, but a little bit less far reaching in what it was. It may have been, you know, a little bit less, because it wouldn't have been being led by someone who is perceived as being what Johnson was perceived in, and having the power that Johnson did to make it happen too in Congress. But I definitely do think, you know, the thing that popped into my head, Dylan, when you were talking about that, is that it's almost like it's the return of that progressive element of the Republicans from the early 20th century in a slightly different flavor, a slightly different way, but they're recapturing two things, the party of Lincoln and the party of Roosevelt, TR in this case, becomes sort of, you know, who they are in the early 60s with Nixon in his second term. And Nixon, as every president would be in his second term there in the early 60s, he's a lame duck. So you're already looking forward to the 64 election, and how do we hold this, or how does this, you know, how does this play its way out? Any other big things in, because I wanted to get to that 64 election. I think it becomes the interesting place that we go here. Is there any other big stuff in that 60 to 64 period that we definitely don't want to miss over before we get headed too far down the track?
Yeah, I want to say one thing, continuing the legal thing, just to kind of set up for later, because I think the impact is not going to be super determinable in 60 to 64, but in 64 to the mid 70s, it becomes a much more interesting discussion. And that is, if Ike dies in 55, even before the 60 election, Nixon then gets two Supreme Court vacancies. If you talk, he wins the 60 election, you get another one and a half if you count that he's replacing one of his own. And this is in the middle of the Warren Court, which is probably, you know, one of the more well-known Supreme Court sort of runs in 20th century, you know, jurisprudence. Not to give too much away, but there's a few famous cases you guys may have heard of from the Warren Court. I'm going to go down a list in no particular order, but obviously Roe versus Wade is the one that you know, most people know. Griswold versus Connecticut, which legalized contraceptive buying under a right to privacy. Gideon versus Wainwright. So a lot of criminal defense stuff, the right to an attorney in federal cases. Miranda, you know, if any of you have ever seen a cop show, that case might have been decided differently under, depending on who Nixon had decided to appoint. Katz, which is Fourth Amendment search protections. Jacobellis, which is the famous pornography First Amendment case where Justice William Brennan uttered the "I know it when I see it" line. Ann Loving versus Virginia. So we're talking in terms of a decade, this is probably the most consequential decade of the 20th century in terms of Supreme Court precedent. So from a longer perspective, you know, imagining what the United States would look like in the 70s and 80s and 90s based on some of these cases that might have been decided differently is just a total head trip.
And, you know, without it, this is one of those tough to knows, you know, these cases would have manifested themselves before whoever was on that court in some way, shape, form, or fashion. You know, one of the things that I remember, you know, my degree's in political science, I don't get to use it, but one of the things I remember specifically there is what gets heard by the court. It's not an automatic thing, you know, that you're actually going to even get the chance to have that argued before the Supreme Court. They may look at the filing, you know, the petition, the appeal, and say, nope, we're just going to let what the lower court did stand. Or, you know, we think about these things, well, yes, they would have all come to the court and they would have all been argued and a decision would have been made. It would be the same decision, a different decision, you know, the different makeup there, you know, what's the majority opinion. But in some cases, there's no guarantee that that even gets heard. Because that's one of the things that the court even decides is, okay, you know, are we even going to listen to this? Or are we just going to, you know, let the lower court ruling stand, right? And, you know, so I can easily imagine, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the Miranda case. I can easily imagine that going to any Supreme Court that would exist where they want to weigh in on what that is, you know, the Gideon case when it comes to representation. I can see that. But that doesn't mean every other case you've listed there, Dylan, we would even know about, because some of them would have just stayed at the appellate level, and that's where they would have stayed.
Also, I don't believe I heard you mention it. This also does a little bit touch on our foreign policy, the Tinker case. Free speech rights there.
Any lawyers who are listening are going to just put me in the stockade because I'm blanking on that one. I do property law, so I don't have to think about Tinker, these kinds of things.
Tinker was, I want to say, some high school students that wore black armbands to protest the war in Vietnam.
Yes. It's like the flag burning and all of those cases. Yes. Even especially, you know, those may not happen because, you know, not even getting to the foreign policy stuff, but we don't even know if Vietnam would come anywhere close to what it's like in the real timeline because you don't have Kennedy and Johnson.
Yeah. Are they wearing those black armbands for Cuba or for the Congo or any of the other places that we talked about where the Cold War and that has flared up. So do you think we end up there with a, you know, that putting you on the spot there, Dylan, how different would this anti-war in court potentially be? I mean, do you think that necessarily that Nixon appointees would be that much different than the late Eisenhower, in this case particularly the Kennedy appointees, that would have been, you know, nixed by this whole change?
Yeah, so I think it's still actually going to be the Warren court, because Warren, I think, was the chief justice until 69. So it's just going to be a different Warren court. You're not going to have a Warren commission. So that's an interesting tidbit. Well, maybe, we don't know, but you're not going to have that Warren commission. I think some things are going to be pretty much the same. You know, I think, you know, whether the specific case and the rationale behind it and the facts are the same, I think you're still going to have some of these sort of evolutions in right to privacy and free speech stuff, particularly with demonstrations, you know, over the course of the 60s, because there's just so many demonstrations going on for various things. Something is going to pop up, some facts that the court's going to be able to do, you know, First Amendment stuff in the school context or free speech context. Your searches, because you have the FBI and various police forces going and doing so much more searches when you have so many more protests. Those things, I think, you know, they may come, you know, a year or two early or late. I don't think those are going to change. But some things like Roe, Griswold, Loving, some of the more equal protection due process arguments, you know, it's depending on who specifically is put on the court, you know, you may not see some of those start coming until the 70s or even the 80s or 90s, depending on future presidents who appoint future justices and things that come on down the line. I don't think, you know, any of those necessarily are off the table immediately, but I think the timeline and how they're decided and sort of the exact bounds are just all over the place.
Okay. Chris, any thoughts on that?
I thought we were putting a pin in this till the 64 election. But
that was just a suggestion.
We came back to it.
Yeah.
I agree with all of these things. I think it's interesting just to keep in mind, like, we are, and this is a good way to bring us back to what I feel like. What is the political left-right orientation of a Nixon 60 administration? Because are these people really that different in terms of their views than the Kennedy appointees? We just got done talking that this new Nixon is kind of the continuation of a progressive streak within the Republican Party. So these are, you know, he's more of a big government, but also maybe these appointees are also a little more cognizant of the power of big government. The one thing I would say that I think is very interesting that we didn't, we danced around it a little bit with the mentioning of the protest movement. The one thing is, are there anti-communist cases? Are there national security cases in terms of, I'm thinking about, I want to say it was Daniels v. United States in 1940, where just membership in the Communist Party was enough to get you convicted. So are there cases like that that are heard under a Nixon court?
I think there are at least five or six, because there were about five or six that were heard in Kennedy and Johnson's administration. I think that's where the result, I think, gets kind of interesting. You almost get kind of more semi-dystopian, depending on your political outlook, in terms of heading towards like a more Watchmen. Nixon's in his seventh term in the 80s and everything's gone to, down the pot, in terms of some of those cases that decided that, you know, communists don't necessarily have to register in certain contexts or cannot be required. Depending on who's on the court and how much weight Nixon can throw at it, that may not be the same outcome. You know, you may have some registries that continue, not necessarily indefinitely, but for a lot longer than they did in our timeline.
Yeah. And actually, I think I raised this in our discussion before we started recording, is that it was amazing to me. You know, again, I mentioned, you know, what was the genesis of this episode? It was a previous episode. We left a lot of, you know, open threads here. Let's go back and tie some of these on and tie some of these up. But I think I mentioned this when Dylan was the one that suggested, you know, did you even think about the court? I'm the lawyer here. I'm going to be the one that raises that. And it's like, no, but we should have, because, you know, now in our presidential politics in the United States, that's one of the primary things that we talk about during a presidential election, is that person's ability to appoint members to not just the Supreme Court, but all of the federal benches, of course. But, you know, and we just totally went by that. That's that other branch, you know, it's easy to forget that, but it has the influence that we've talked about here without a doubt.
Yeah. And I think that actually sets us up nicely for 64, because the judiciary aspect is sort of one of the big consistencies between Eisenhower, our Nixon, and the real Nixon, was this kind of law and order stability sort of, you know, ideology to it. You know, in this timeline, we're talking about, you know, Nixon is the one who is, you know, advancing civil rights by calling in and federalizing the National Guard. He's the one who's continuing Teddy Roosevelt's, you know, antitrust use of the Justice Department in now advancing civil rights legislation instead. So he's become this sort of, you know, we're not talking about maybe a big administrative government where there's lots of alphabet soup agencies, although he does do, you know, the EPA and OSHA and a couple others. You're looking more at a more prosecutorially liberal, you know, administration, whereas the Democrats may be more sort of like hearkening back to that semi-small government, but also, hey, we're the guys that did the New Deal and saved everyone from the Depression. You know, everybody's kind of a big government. It's just a question of in what ways is the government big versus not, as kind of being the big, at least domestic policy question of 64.
Okay. So we're coming up now to that 64 election. So we're assuming here that Nixon's not going to pull an FDR and claim that there's a crisis that needs him to run for term number three. We're assuming that he's going to actually, you know.
And by the way, at least by this point, Nixon is, whatever you say about FDR, there was not a constitutional amendment banning it for him. There is one banning it for Nixon.
Yeah, I was about to go there. He's only going to do that because he sort of has to if he's going to uphold the Constitution, right? So he can't run for that elusive third term. So who do we think is trying to be his successor, continuing the Republican position in the White House?
Chris, do you want to take this one?
I was going to let you.
All right. I guess I'm the newbie. I got to do it. I think obviously you hear people talk about Nelson Rockefeller was the big sort of counter to Nixon in the real timeline. But interestingly enough, there was a candidate who actually was more popular, I looked this up, than Rockefeller or George Romney in some early polling in front of the early 60s primaries. And that is a distinguished Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., who actually was Nixon's vice president in 1960. So he's got even more credentials than he did in our timeline to be able to sort of step up as the mantle, you know, and the incumbent vice president to take over and continue, you know, the Eisenhower Nixon doctrine at this point, it's probably going to start being.
Okay. So Chris, who's contending from the donkey side?
Just one other point. I will say, I do find it. We did not discuss who the secondary Republican, who the Republican running mate is, but I really like a Nelson Rockefeller for this one. I think that's really interesting, but, you unmuted. Do you want to chime in on at least Nixon's run or Lodge's running mate?
No, I was actually Nelson Rockefeller was the one I was thinking of too, because down the, in, you know, 15, 20 years into the future, I have an idea of what's going to happen between Rockefeller and Reagan. Not to set up too much of the game, but there's some interesting stuff that could be happening. So I like the Rockefeller, you know, thing.
Yeah. On the Democratic side, what we thought about was a little bit like what happened on the Republican side in the 1960s, where we let the hard base of the party, I guess is one way of saying it, or the crazies have a nomination. The Republicans let them do it in 64 with Goldwater and got slaughtered. And I feel like the Democrats have given the conservative Dixiecrats some red meat in the 1960 nomination of Strom Thurmond. Again, got slaughtered, and now are, I think the New Deal is very popular, and everybody is kind of interesting, and I think this is really interesting, trying to almost tearing over the New Deal, trying to claim we're the New Deal party, we're the party continuing this, because these things can be pretty popular. So they nominate JFK and Johnson, their 60 running team in 64 in our scenario. Is that kind of everyone in agreement?
It's where I'm at. That's what we talked about off podcast. So I think it's as good as anything. There probably are great, you know, suggestions. By the way, if you have suggestions, you know, pop to the website or pop in on the Discord server and let us know, because we know there's a lot of candidates out there, but it's also cleaner because we sort of know what that ticket looks like in a lot of ways from real history. So it's easier to make the jump over to that. Although remembering a couple of important things here, we're not talking about foreign policy, so we don't know how much that would play necessarily into the 64 presidential election cycle in terms of how that was influencing where the hearts and minds of voters were.
Unfortunately, when I was thinking this whole thing up, I was just saying, well, we'll just determine the domestic and the political side now and just have that side play into the foreign policy. So we'll lay the base with this for the third episode.
Yeah. But the other part of that is, remember, he's still young. But we're now dealing with a Kennedy that is 4 years older than we had in the real timeline. And we say, what difference does that make? Well, there's probably less of that, you know, what are your credentials? You know, what have you done? There may be more for that, you know, 64 Kennedy candidate to point to in terms of, you know, more experience, et cetera, that didn't exist with the 60 candidates. That's a small thing, but it may be a big thing depending on what the topics are in that election. The other thing that I think I'd suggested off podcast, I'll just bring it forward here, is that you have what I call the pendulum effect in American potential, particularly American presidential politics. One party normally, with few exceptions in the history of the United States, doesn't hold that position for an exceptionally long period of time. There's normally a reversal for all kinds of reasons back. And so understanding that we had in this alternate timeline, Ike is elected in 52. Nixon has had two terms. So we've now had Republicans in office for 12 years. And if you look back historically, while that's not unprecedented, you know, barring something unusual going on, there's a tendency in American politics for the other party to either A, get its act together and find the cleaving issues that they can use to rest that, or there's just this thing of, well, they've had it long enough, now we're going to flip back in the other direction from the American electorate. So I think that is playing a factor in the 64 election, you know, whether Lodge can persist, Intercabinet Lodge Union can persist against a challenge from a Kennedy-Johnson ticket in 64, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think Kennedy ends up actually being the victor of 64, just because I think Lodge, you know, like you talked about, you know, after 12 years, people kind of want to see, you know, okay, I'm tired of grape Kool-Aid. Let me see what cherry tastes like, just to remind myself. I think Lodge also, you know, ends up having to live down some things that he was involved with, not to get too into the foreign policy bit, but some things he was involved with certain regime changes in South Vietnam that he probably still is involved in under a Nixon presidency in 64 to some degree, that he still has to deal with and can't quite stomach before the election.
Right.
You know, so I think Kennedy ends up winning it. The question is, does it then just become, you know, everything that Kennedy and Johnson did, but 4 years later? You know,
Look how he did the leading question there. There's the attorney at work right there, Dylan. Well done.
I think it's everything Kennedy Johnson did, because I think some of those things have already been done by a Nixon.
Yeah. And the place that we went to here, so I'm going to go ahead and introduce sort of the left turn that goes off of this, but is not too far to go from this. If you say Nixon to anyone, you know, I remember Nixon resigning because he interrupted my cartoons. That's the age that I am. Okay. So I remember, I don't remember a Nixon presidency because I was middle single digits when it happened, but I remember when it happened and, you know, learned about it later and then learned every scandal that came after that had to have Gate attached to it, no matter what it was, because of the Watergate scandal. What was suggested, I'm going to go here because we have evidence potentially from the 60 election, certainly anything you've ever read about Lyndon Johnson and getting elected. There's questions about how some of that went down at various places. And I'm allowed to say that I am a Texan and he is too, Chris. But I will argue he is the Texan president. We can definitely say that.
I actually made that argument on a regular basis.
Right. But what you had suggested was, what if the election in 64, for the reasons that Dylan said, you know, let's try the other flavor of Kool-Aid, all the things that are going on there. And again, you know, my knowledge of political parties is they do figure out when they're out of power, what is going to appeal to the electorate, because we haven't been winning. So that's part of why you see that shift go back, not just the change for change sake or balance sake, but also because the losing party tends to figure out, what do we got to do different to not keep losing anymore, or there's enough change. But what you had suggested, Chris, and I suggested in a previous discussion we had off podcast, is maybe there's some impropriety in that 64 election that comes along, because this is still the age very much of machine politics in a lot of ways that hasn't gone away. And so maybe around 65 or 66, maybe there's a little question about what went on during this 64 election that we've imagined here. Chris, might what that look like?
I'm actually going, so there, when you hear people talk about our timeline's 1960 election, there are generally two places that you'll hear mentions of impropriety. And, generally Texas, while we're pretty sure it happened, isn't the headline case of it. It's not the star case of it. It's not the popular mythology case of it. That would be Chicago, who, as somebody who works in politics, I still can regularly make jokes about Illinois rules not excluding dead people from voting rolls. People still get that. And very much in 1960, there were a lot of accusations that Southern Illinois the more Republican parts, their votes were counted. And long story short, certain people made calls to the Daily Machine and told them to find me X number of votes. If we've ever heard of that before. In this case, they did find those many votes, and Illinois did go for Kennedy, as did Texas. And those are the two states that wound up putting him over the top. In our scenario here, those same things happen. And it comes to light some of the connections that Kennedy had, some of the strings he pulled to make this happen. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
Now I'm going to unmute myself. I'm going to say, I want to be very clear. We're making an assertion here, but it's an assertion based upon things that we know did happen in elections of that age and were involving some of the parties that we're talking about here. So this idea of impropriety, by the way, probably would have been on both sides there because it went on everywhere, but it notably had an impact, we're suggesting here, with whether it actually would change the outcome of the election. Sometimes it doesn't matter if it perceives that it changes the outcome of the election. It has the same effect. And so, you know, maybe sometime in late 65, early 66, some of this comes to light. And so you have the equivalent of what we have in the early 70s with Watergate now circling around the Kennedy-Johnson presidency. We don't know what's happening rest of the world. Tune in on a future episode. That'll be fun to know when we finally do know. But domestically, this is not going to be small news. For all the reasons that it's not going to be small news. And there's a couple of different ways that we can have an outcome there, right, guys? Up to and including, yeah. I will resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow, being something that is potentially uttered from someone's mouth.
Yeah, I think I don't know that it would get all the way to a resignation at noon tomorrow, but I think you at least have, you know, some serious credibility questions that have to be answered for Kennedy. You know, I think he's going to have to, you know, assuming this comes to light in 65 or early 66, you know, I think he gets maybe 2 years of a Democratic legislature and then he's fighting Republicans the whole way. So a lot of what we might normally think of as Kennedy-Johnson legislative victories, even assuming there are some parallels between what did happen and what might happen, I think those are few and far between. You're fighting for whatever scraps you can get. There's also, you know, you've got to remember that Kennedy's already fighting an uphill PR battle in some circumstances because, one, he's the first Catholic president. So, you know, there are some subsets of the electorate who anytime he does something wrong are going to find some sort of suspicious activity with that. And Dear Dad had his own sort of ignominious exit from politics at the end of the lead up to World War II. So people might start saying that, well, it's just those Kennedys that just can't be helped, you know, so you start seeing maybe. You know, the Kennedy name doesn't even come close to what it means in our time. I don't know that we use the word gate for everything because that's so specific to Watergate. But, a Harvard switcheroo is probably, you know, or something like that, some bit of lexicon that becomes shorthand for, you know, a politician trying to get something by on everyone instead of pull the wool over or something, you know, what have you.
The one thing that goes through my mind, and I'm hearkening back to the live stream episode we did, if I can throw this in there, Don, you strongly suggested you think that LBJ might have known something about an assassination attempt. Now, if we say that he's in on that, what's to say? And you, Dylan, please look at Don's face because you're about to see that face he makes when I just come out with something. What if Johnson is leaking some of the information about these improprieties to move aside this young upstart who's not
Yeah, I made the comment. I believe it. Eventually, some version of this will end up in our Inspired By shirts in the store. For those of you that have checked those out, we're going to have the LBJ new. I actually have the prototypes that I'm working on now. I just haven't come to the one that I really like yet. That still is, it has to be politically correct enough, because there we're talking about assassination. If LBJ knew about the cheating, or actually maybe even in the middle of it, but he chooses to leak things out, you know, the particular things that are beneficial to him, I can believe that. Lennon was a player. Lennon was an absolute political player, and I can easily imagine that. And while it would be short-term negative to the party, it would be long-term net positive to Lyndon. And so I can imagine that scenario. I think what I mentioned in the off podcast discussion was, you know, at some point here, does LBJ become the Democratic version of Gerald Ford, you know, kind of thing, except that, you know, Ford was never elected even as the vice presidency because of the appointment. But I could certainly imagine that scenario where how it comes to life is, you know, or the other way to think about it is LBJ is Deep Throat. He's just the different version of Deep Throat, right? That's
literally where I was going. And I see Dylan just off screen for a moment, not even thinking about all of the bathroom humor that comes from this that we all have heard about. I was going to say,
there's too many stories about Lyndon Johnson. Let's not go anywhere near Deep Throat and some of those implications.
But so it would definitely be, you know, by the way, Deep Throat would not have the same meaning. It would not be mentioned in political parlance whatsoever.
Because it's too early for the cross reference there that caused that to be in other ways. Yeah. It's amazing. Again, it's amazing how much, you know, parlance gets in. Like, say, everything becomes a gate only because of Watergate. You know, so it's probably some county in southern Illinois, you know, that stuff gets named for here, or some official, you know, in terms of the scenario you laid out, Chris, in terms of where it's at. And then suddenly everything that happens after that picks up that moniker, you know, whatever it is in the process there. So yeah, we have to sort of choose here if we're going to go down this path. Do we let Kennedy survive this scandal, or do we think this does him in? Because I think that is important in the sense that a wounded politically Kennedy sliding up now into the 68 election is different than a scenario where, imagine the scenario where you had Reagan running in 76 for the Republicans after Nixon and Watergate, of where, you know, you, someone comes in intentionally saying, yes, I have an R after my name, but I'm not that kind of R kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where I can see Kennedy resigning just to save the sort of Harvard wing of the Democratic Party, because you've got, you know, the Kennedys are this old Boston Democratic family. There's two other Kennedys waiting in the wings that, you know, whether they end up being the same as they were in our timeline or some equivalent of it. I think John, especially, you know, he may decide under pressure from the family and from that part of the party to sort of, you know, cut it, stop the bleeding, get out before it becomes worse and the whole party is dragged down, you know, especially after now being out of power for 12 years, you've got a triage, and Johnson is the best that incumbent that you can do, the incumbent vice president. I think then the question then becomes, okay, once the Harvard wing gets out, what happens to the Democratic Party? You know, Johnson still very much a progressive New Deal Democrat, but he is, while not a quote unquote Southern Democrat, he is a Democrat in the South. So under Johnson presidency, without a Harvard contingent, so to speak, there may be some, you know, different ways that the Democratic Party then starts going after, you know, say 67, maybe, or if he resigns in early 68 before the election.
Now I have a different speech in my head. I will not I will not seek, nor will I accept the nomination, you know, tying that to 68 mm-hmm. now coming out of Kennedy's mouth to sort of clear the deck for the primary season there. Chris, you have any thoughts on that?
I find it interesting. Let's go ahead and turn everything on its head. First, I just love the idea of getting rid of Kennedy. He didn't do a whole lot. I'm just saying that. I like my legislation passed. Two, to address Dylan's idea about what happens to the Democratic Party once you get rid of the Harvard wing, I think it goes to the Rust Belt. It goes to a lot of where we're seeing a lot of this kind of discontent, and to kind of throw it out there, you see, and I realize I'm going to use a name from our timeline and our time, but you see Tim Ryan Democrats. You see more populist, more white working class in the North, as opposed to that kind of understanding of the New Deal. Because as I was talking about, they're both fighting over this memory of the New Deal now. And I think the populist economic aspect of it works well for a Johnson, while the Republicans have adopted the mantle of the racial equality aspect of it. Do people have thoughts on that?
Yeah. This is where I think I mentioned this repeatedly in the inspiring episode here. This is where it starts getting hard, because you don't know what variables you are allowed to keep as constants and what's changing here. You know, so one of the things that we said was foreign policy is sort of off the, so it becomes a constant in our discussion today. You don't know what impact it would be having on this. And the thing you don't know is, we've gone through enough period of time here, there would have been natural economic cycles. And the timing of those economic cycles, as we know, impact presidential elections. And so, you know, if it's for whatever reason it might be, that could be playing a backseat here. You know, is it, for example, is it a populist type of thing that's now centered around, you know, I like what we've done on voting rights. I like that we are more progressive when it comes to race relations now, but where's my paycheck? you know, kind of thing that plays into politics. And so, you know, I think this is that hard place to be. I think the more informed you are, the harder it even gets, is the realization that these are esoteric, nice theoretical discussions, that electoral politics often hinge around things that are very different than this. And the economy, it's the economy, stupid. It's one of those things.
Yeah. And I think at the very least, I think if we're looking at a 68 election where Johnson is the, I guess we'll call him a quasi incumbent, because he's probably not even had 2 years of a presidential term. He's at least got the Democratic legislative resume to say, we're heading into a tailwind. Things are not looking great, but you guys remember Roosevelt used the New Deal to turn around the economy in the 30s. I've got a whole new legislative proposal that I can use to turn around the economy in the late 60s, early 70s. So I think it, you know, at least that sort of part of the Great Society stuff, I think probably actually sounds really good to a voter in 1968 in terms of, you know, Social Security bolstering, economic stability, Medicaid, things like that. You know, maybe not so much of the, you know, the Fair Housing Act and some of that part of the civil rights stuff, but I think in terms of the Social Security net stuff, I think that might actually get Johnson to a win in 68 in spite of Kennedy, because of the economic stuff that's going on. I think it was unemployment was like 7% heading into that election, I think, in 68.
Yeah.
Economics wins.
I very much all of that resonates with me, Dylan, for the reasons that it does. Of course, we don't know, because in our hypothetical, we don't know how the economy's been impacted by the things that have impacted it because of the changes that we've made, the butterfly effect. But I could easily see Johnson, because of his political savvy, being one part of it. You know, it's nice to have Texas electoral votes already, you know, sort of leaning in your direction when you get going there. That's a good place to start from, right? In terms of just the way the electoral map works. And, you know, the idea of, you know, of a great society kind of thing, you know, it's the second coming of the New Deal, but it's also been altered by the way we've altered the history in between. So it has a little bit different flavor to it. And again, who knows if there's no Vietnam backdrop where the problem of the great society was, how do you spend to fight a war at the same time spend to do all these things domestically? The problem is you don't have enough money to do both.
Or does this make the great society just that much easier without that other draw on spending?
That's my, you know, I think it's far easier to see and I think the Great Society did some good things. You know, I'll just say that. But I think it's far easier to see how it could have been different and maybe even more successful. Being able to do some things faster and more effectively if you had the bucks to back the what you're trying to do there and you weren't needing the dollars because of. The Cold War still is a backdrop behind all of this. You need dollars being spent on defense spending just because you still have, you know, your concerns about the Soviets globally in the Cold War scenario. But I think you could see a more effective Great Society type of program.
I am going to throw this because it is so much of a foreign policy issue at this point. But I do feel, and this is a big advertisement, Eric Rush, congratulations on your new house, and make sure you're on the next one when we do this again, because I feel like we want to talk about the space race as a foreign policy issue, though.
I agree. And again, I think we did the right thing by breaking up the domestic foreign aspects of this. But it does set up for what does this domestic stuff impact on foreign policy? And we've been precluded from talking about the foreign policy impacts back on domestic at the same time, but they're both there. Wow. It continues to have so many threads, even though we tied some of the loose ones up and we opened some others. Ike's smoking habit was big. American history. That's the end of the. That's the conclusion that I've come to. The fact that he, you know, skirted death in the real timeline. The fact that he didn't in ours. It's big. It has ripples. All right. Miss anything big, guys?
So let me go ahead and throw this at Dylan. Since we've rearranged all of this to bring it back to kind of your home turf, does Elvis become a official DEA agent?
No, because we still haven't gotten, you know, at this point, we're still pre-68 comeback special Elvis. I think Once we start getting into an alternate 1970s, you know, just to throw one possibility out there, Elvis doing a show with Nancy Reagan in the mid-70s to say no to drugs instead of, you know, Nancy Reagan by herself in the late 80s. I don't know, full DEA agent. That's a little too.
Or maybe even an interesting Elvis kind of picking up. I saw an interesting documentary on the interrelationship between Jimmy Carter's 67 campaign and the Allman Brothers. Yes.
Yes, I think Elvis, like if Reagan or Rockefeller were to run, I think you'd see Elvis as kind of like the house band almost.
Would he be on that side, or would you have kind of Elvis being on the more Southern populist Johnson? And you have like the old, by the way, just to throw this out there to people to blow your minds, the old square Sinatra band on the other side of the Democratic ticket.
Now, keep in mind that both of those people would be of the sort of social clique that would be in the midst of a Republican governed California at this time. So there's that interesting thing. I don't know. That we might have to do another four or five of these.
I'm a big believer. You know, we don't have a king in this country, but it all comes back to the king, right? All right. Anything else before we close out, guys?
Just one other. I'm going to close this out. Yeah, Elvis is still the king. We haven't adopted another royal family.
There are Presleys still alive. You don't know that. Things could change.
No. What I'm saying is the American political class may not have its royal family.
Ah, because are you suggesting that a certain family that begins with a K sort of fits that role, Chris?
That he's not in there long enough to be handing out appointments to everything, to every second cousin he has.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this, I think, even on The Room Where It Happened, as we talked about the Parkland episode and other things. You know, the Kennedy mystique, not to speak ill of the dead, obviously, or particularly of the assassinated, but, you know, if Kennedy's not shot, you know,
how many schools are named Richard Nixon Middle School?
Yeah, it is a fact of American political life and American political history that the Kennedy legacy, we had a lot of things that can tarnish it. We've talked about some of those things that can tarnish it, that go back a generation before JFK, go back to Dad, you know, go back to the brothers and the other things that are there. We haven't even mentioned, you know, the other event, the youngest brother. But that assassination makes Kennedy revered. And, you know, we talked about this on the, you know, the Parkland episode of Room Where It Happened, Chris, is, you know, who made that, who passed that legislation, who pushed that legislation through? Not JFK, LBJ is the one that made that happen. And it, you know, could it have happened while Kennedy was still president? Maybe, but not the same way it did when LBJ was. That's just a fact, in my opinion. So, good stuff. Dylan, thanks for joining us. We're going to have you back. You're too much fun not to have back. And I'm glad that you jumped in on this. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the episode that Dylan and I did, which falls in more of our pop culture vein, we've been doing a lot more of those lately, and I'm okay with that because, you know, the hard history is the hard history, but the soft history is fun. But Dylan, I really appreciate the perspective that you brought, not just as an Elvis fan here, although that was an important thing for us to get in at the end, but the perspective, particularly on the Supreme Court and your perspective as an attorney, I think helped a lot in thinking through a whole aspect of this that we had totally missed on the first episode. So I'm glad we picked it up here. The Supreme Court is different because the president's different. And if you don't connect those two things together, it's easy to miss that subtle change. Anything you want to say, Dylan, before we sign off?
Actually, speaking of the Supreme Court, that actually is one thing that Johnson can probably still manage to do is screw up a Supreme Court appointment. Abe Fortas is a buddy of Johnson's who was on the Supreme Court, and then kind of there was some weird stuff that went on and he resigned. So I'm sure if, assuming Johnson wins in 68, there's still a way to screw that up.
Never underestimate LBJ's abilities. That's all I'm saying.
Or a fiddle player on Beale Street, which is what Abe Fortas actually did.
There you go. All right. Chris, Dylan, enjoyed it today. I'm just going to mention to our listeners here as we sign off. If you have thoughts or ideas about episodes, you know, go visit us on the website. We have plenty of places for those to put in. Dylan's actually got a couple of other suggestions in there that we haven't even got around to yet. I was looking at the list today. They're on the queue list that we have, and so we'll get around to those. I've mentioned this a lot here in the last couple of months because we've been getting it set up, and Dylan's been an active participant there, which is why I want to mention as well. We've got our Discord server up and going, and so that's a great place, sort of more in real time, to get a conversation. We know Alexis and I often use that term, and we believe about this community when it comes to the group of our listeners. That's where you can interact with the whole community. Before, I would just get an email and maybe pass it on to the team, and I would respond back to that email. Now, if you go and put a suggestion there, you'll hear back probably from one of the members of the team who will chime in on it, but you'll also maybe hear from Dylan, or you might hear from somebody else who's jumped in on. We have some of our UK listeners that are active participants there, for example. So it's a good place to throw some feedback there. For example, this episode, there will be a place to throw feedback on that. So if you thought of something we didn't think of, or if you disagree with Chris, which is perfectly okay because we all at some level disagree with Chris, at least for a short period of time, throw your disagreement in there. If you like what Dylan said, you know, give him a big thumbs up, whatever the case might be. I just put that call out to the Discord server. I did want to mention that we are coming up into a couple of series that we know that we're going to kick off in. In the next 2 to 3 weeks, we will be circling back around with Bo Breslin to pick up the sort of pause that we did there on the Living Constitution. I'm really excited to get back into that. I know that Eric Rush is going to be leading part of the charge on that because he's excited about it as well. So that's coming. And keep those topic ideas coming. So, Chris, if we happen along a fork in time, do we have any recommendations for our listeners?
Take it.
Take it. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more and provide feedback by visiting our website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Connect to us on Facebook at facebook.com/aforkintime or follow us on Twitter at AFIT Podcast. If you want to support the show financially, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/aforkintime. We hope you will join us next time.